Institutional investor groups are the latest voices calling for governments around the world to plan for a sustainable recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic. Last month, we spoke with New Zealand's Climate Change Commissioner, Dr. Rod Carr, who was urging the government here to stimulate the economy post-pandemic in a way that keeps climate change progress happening. In the past week, the UN Secretary-General, the International Energy Agency, major German businesses and Britain's business secretary have called for a green and sustainable stimulus. The Investor Group on Climate Change represents Australian and New Zealand institutional investors and advisers, including the New Zealand Super Fund, and has over $2 trillion Australian dollars under management. It's joined a group of similar organisations around the world in a big plea that has just been issued. $35 trillion under management these organisations around the world have. They're asking governments to prioritise human relief and job creation, but to do so in a way that upholds the Paris Agreement and prioritises climate resilience and net zero emissions solutions. Emma Hurd is the Chief Executive of the Investor Group on Climate Change, is on the line from Sydney. Hello, Emma.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning also to Matt Winneray, the Chief Executive of the New Zealand Super Fund.
Morena, Catherine.
Emma, could you tell us a little bit more? Who is among this group of investor groups who've made the plea?
Yeah, it does seem a little bit like a group of groups, but effectively it's similar investor networks to ourselves, representing institutional investors like pension funds and large infrastructure investors who've joined together in a shared statement of principles around what investors are really looking for when governments begin planning for the economic recovery from COVID. So we have groups from Asia, from Europe, from the US, and of course ourselves from the local region, really kind of setting out what we think would be a useful set of principles to consider when beginning to plan for the economic recovery from COVID-19.
The group globally has massive assets under investment, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, these are big investors, right? So these are some of the biggest investors from around the world. We've got about seven different groups representing the different regions. In our own region itself, as you mentioned, more than $2 trillion in assets under management. Collectively, I think a lot of our organisations are managing trillions of dollars of capital and are really looking at how can they get involved, how can they have the conversation with governments in all regions around promoting a sustainable recovery. So this is really the big end of the big end of town, so to speak.
What exactly are you calling for? Are you looking for projects that shift the dial on these longer-term high-risk issues, such as the ongoing use of fossil fuels, for example, and climate emissions? What exactly are you calling for?
Yeah, look, I think what we're really saying is that it's entirely appropriate that governments have been really focused on protecting human life and continue to prioritise the really immediate needs for people of job creation. So that's, I mean, first and foremost, that's incredibly important. But what we're also saying is you have to do that and at the same time manage for the other great, you know, systemic crisis of our time, which is climate change. And in the steps that governments take to begin to kickstart the economy as we all come out of lockdown, it's incredibly important that we're really maintaining and upholding the commitments that we've made under the Paris Agreement. So under the Paris Agreement, we've said that we will all take action to limit global warming to less than 2 degrees and hopefully to keep it at 1.5 degrees. So I guess what we're saying is when you're looking to restart the economy, don't throw away all of that good work. Make sure that you use the process to really begin to plan for how do we bring money and investment into projects which also meet our goals under the Paris Agreement. And at the same time, which increase the resilience of our communities, which future-proof our communities for the increasing effects, unfortunately, of climate change itself. So this can include a number of different things. It can include embedding the assessment of climate risk in any decisions around government support, and in particular for those carbon-intensive companies that do receive public funding to ensure that climate change transition plans are in place on how to achieve the goals under the Paris Agreement. It also means trying to find and prioritise climate solutions as part of those investment decisions. And it's really saying that investors want to be part of those discussions because from the finance community perspective, we're very focused on how we can get more money flowing into climate change solutions, including as we move forward with some of the government packages around promoting a sustainable recovery. So this can include any number of things, but as its core principle, we have to stick with Paris and we have to be looking for carbon solutions.
Emma, was that transition into more sustainable technologies and fuel sources actually happening? Was it moving from paper agreements to actual investment pre-COVID?
Yeah, I mean, pre-COVID, what we're seeing is that the finance sector is moving money, not enough and not fast enough, but it is moving money into climate solutions. And I have to say, I don't think it would be any surprise to say faster in New Zealand than in Australia, to be honest. But we're also saying that the finance sector is both looking to make sure that they are getting the really carbon-intensive assets off their books and are looking to put more money and make hard dollar commitments into getting investment into climate solutions. So this is not a hard switch. It's quite, you know, in for many economies, it is a transition. It is a process, but it was definitely happening. And in fact, even in the last few weeks, while we've been under lockdown and COVID, you know, we've seen a whole range of additional financial institutions making public commitments around ruling out lending to carbon-intensive industries like thermal coal, for example, and we've seen a whole number of new commitments being made for hard dollars into climate solutions. That's continuing. Even yesterday, Westpac coming out with a new climate change strategy, also continuing that trend around risk and opportunity on climate change as well. So it is happening, but it needs to be happening faster.
In the private sector, which is, you know, obviously focused on that bottom line, first and foremost, what are the bottom line arguments for this shift in focus in investing? Is it risk based?
It's both. So it is risk based. So any co-investment, well, we know the governments are going to need co-investment from the private sector. Any co-investment has to be managing for risk, including climate risk. But at the same time, we know that we have to get more money flowing into climate solutions, into property, into infrastructure, into energy upgrades and into transport. All of these are projects which can be deployed in a way that's both relatively quick to really provide that economic stimulus, relatively quick, they're large projects, but also which can be done in a way that prioritises the climate and the green overlay as well. So it's really what we're really saying is let's use the unfortunate events of 2020 to kickstart our planning for moving to net zero emissions by 2050.
Do you believe that markets and even governments are mispricing the risk of existing assets and what's going to happen to them under climate change?
Oh, I think that we are not yet fully pricing in the risks and what's going to happen to them under climate change. I think it's changing rapidly, but I don't think that we are fully pricing in the risks of climate change. So that is an area where it is a work in progress, but it is moving very quickly, that's for sure.
Is the fear that in the rush to urgently stimulate and spend, in the case of this country, tens of billions of dollars that might otherwise not have been spent at this rate, in the rush to stimulate economies, countries will fall back on, in your case, coal exports to China, or road building, or all the traditional stuff, because it's ready to go, shovel ready, as we say.
Well, there are lots of things which are shovel ready, and you know, in the case of Australia, actually, some of the most shovel ready projects are actually in green property, where there's huge appetite for improving environmental credentials, so large commercial buildings, shopping centres, for example, where we've seen really significant support from the property sector to move hard into climate-friendly construction. And in energy, where in Australia's case, it's very much the most capital is currently flowing into renewable energy projects and into projects which upgrade transmission infrastructure to support increased deployment of renewable energy. So if it was just up to the private sector, I think you would be seeing much more investment going into those clean solutions. But it's really a question of making sure that when we're making these stimulus decisions, that we don't just think short term, that we don't just go for the quick buck, that we don't throw good money after bad, that we are actually thinking about more than one global crisis when we're making these investment decisions.
Can we, and I'm going to come to Matt on this question as well, but to you, Emma, first, can we talk about what's happening with fossil fuels? Obviously, we had the extraordinary experience of negative pricing in the case of Texas oil on one particular month's contract, and you were basically selling people to take it away. What's going on in this market? We know there has been a price war. Is there a bigger shift happening or not? And I say this because prior to COVID, we'd actually seen, conversely, an increasing investment in fossil fuels companies, driven largely by passive investment funds or index funds that were just tracking investments that already were. Now, was that a false vote of confidence in fossil fuel investment? Is there a much bigger shift getting underway right now? Emma.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. Well, there's a few questions in there, actually, but that's a really good question. And I think it's something that we're a lot of investors are really following extremely closely. I think what we're seeing is that it's you have to sort of unpack that a little bit. So what within the fossil fuels world, what is going on? I think what we're seeing is in terms of thermal coal, there's a number of commitments being made, or a number of announcements being made around the decreasing appetite from the private sector to invest in the expansion and the continuation of thermal coal. Like I said, even yesterday, Westpac announced that they'll be getting out of lending to thermal coal by 2030 altogether. So you're sort of seeing all of these public statements by the finance sector saying, we think that there's risk there. We think that there's structural issues going on. We're getting out. The bigger question is what happens with gas and oil and gas. And that is the really hard part of the equation, because in some countries, gas does present opportunities as a transition fuel. It's cleaner than thermal coal, not as clean as renewables, but there is some potential there. In other jurisdictions, it's much better to just move straight to renewables and into alternative energy sources in many different ways. So it's not a straightforward question. I think in short, though, to answer your question, when you actively begin to, as you identified before, price in climate and price in carbon in those investment and market decisions, people are changing their appetite for fossil fuels and also beginning to think through where are the alternatives. If the world does meet the goals of the Paris Agreement, how do we manage that transition? I guess my final point that I would just sort of say is that you're also seeing that reflected in the announcements from the companies themselves. I mean, we've seen some pretty significant announcements from the really big global companies like Shell and BP making commitments around moving to net zero emissions themselves. And investors are really pushing hard for companies in that sector to achieve that. Even last Friday, we saw a shareholder resolution at one of the big oil and gas companies in Australia, Woodside, get more than 50% of investors saying, we're expecting you to set harder emission reduction targets. So the short answer is yes, but the longer answer is it's complicated, but yes.
Matt, if I can bring you in that question of what's happening with fossil fuels, the other question that was in the question, as Emma rightly pointed out, was that the index funds, the passive funds, had been identified as a driver of growing investment pre-COVID, but they will ultimately track whatever happens with active investments, will they not? This will shake down one way or another over time, Matt.
Oh, that's right. Ultimately, the active investors are making the prices in those assets at the marginal level. But I guess the really interesting thing that's happened as a result of all that turmoil in the oil market is that stranded assets aren't a theoretical concept anymore. So, you know, when oil prices are close to zero or even less than zero, then it doesn't make those reserves that are sitting in the ground worth very much. And so people can see that a lot more clearly and understand that issue, and we see stranded assets in other places as well. So, and I think the other thing that's gone on, and Emma mentioned it, was the some decisions from Shell. Shell cut its dividend this week for the first time since World War II. So clearly they are looking at the future with a lot less confidence than they have in the past. And I guess the positive thing from a climate perspective is that the lower the price in that market, the less economic future exploration activity is, which means it slows. Although, of course, you've got a near-term countervailing influence, which is you've got a lower fuel price into some generation assets.
Before we talk about where investments might head, could we talk about how the super fund, New Zealand Super Fund, has fared through these recent market ructions? What's happened?
So at the end of December, we were at a little under about $46.5 billion. We fell with the market, given that we're significant growth exposure, down to sort of mid-30s. We bounced, we're roughly about 42 at the moment, so we've recovered certainly more than half of the decline, and remain a little bit down for the year, but have recovered a significant amount as a result of the bounce in markets over the course of the last month. And we've been active through that time. We've leant into the market, buying equities as they fell, selling some as they've risen, and actively thinking about whether the long term has changed, because that's the key for us. Has anything changed in terms of our long run assumptions about how we set the portfolio up?
Given the length of recession that is predicted, should people anticipate either further volatility or further losses over a prolonged period of time?
Oh, we absolutely anticipate further volatility, and you've even seen that in the course of the last week or so. So, you know, with markets reacting to new bits of news every day and different economic stats and different COVID stats, they certainly are going to remain volatile. And so our approach is to maintain plenty of liquidity, be able to respond to that, but ultimately as a long-term investor to be able to look through that volatility and generate returns for the long term.
What have you gotten out of then, and what have you seen as opportunities?
Well, in the climate space specifically, so we announced a climate change investment strategy back in 2016, and that saw us reduce, so to your point earlier about risk and return, saw us reduce our exposure to emissions-intensive companies and reserve-intensive companies. And we've done quite a significant amount of work in that. We've reduced our emissions intensity by 43% and our reserves intensity by 52%. And we're continuing to look at those, because both of those have exceeded our original targets, and so we're reviewing those targets now and talking about that with the board. And that's certainly been beneficial from a fund perspective, reducing that exposure to those carbon-heavy assets. On the opportunity side, which is what Emma's talking about, you know, you don't just need to manage the risk in your portfolio, you need to think about, well, how can capital flow into the opportunities presented by this transition to the low-carbon energy system. We've been pretty active on the renewables development front in the US, solar and wind, and more recently in Europe. And of course, you know, light rail is a project that's consistent with that as well. If you've got efficient mass transit powered by, you know, our country's mostly renewable generation, then that's a very positive project from a climate change perspective.
What is the status of your bid, by the way, on the Auckland?
We're still waiting to hear. We'll let you know when we.
You see, sorry to interrupt you. Is there a tone of frustration in that?
No, you know, obviously the government's got stuff to do. We totally appreciate that, and we do too. So, no, we're fine. We'll wait until they're ready to make the decision.
We keep hearing this message that governments in post-COVID should be making sure they are dealing to two problems at once. In New Zealand, what sorts of investments are viable? We're already at 85% plus renewable energy. We may need to increase the actual capacity energy-wise over time. I'm interested in your view on that. But what are the actual potential investments that big funds like yours are looking for?
Well, yeah, Dr. Carr was talking about this, I think, and I've spoken to him about it as well. So, yes, you're right. We've already got a significant percentage of renewables in the generation assets. And so then how do you take advantage of that? It has to be the transition of our transport to electrification. So what comes from that? Things like charging systems as well as distribution systems, and probably a strengthening of the transmission network to be able to distribute all of that electricity. Other things like infrastructure projects that look to adapt to climate change will protect communities from climate change. So they don't all have to be about electricity generation, but if you think about areas that are going to be suffering from the physical effects, the physical impacts of rising sea levels and increased storm activity, how can you shift those? What financial instruments could you create where people could invest in the move in those adaptation protection retreat programs over the long term with some cash to service those assets or those obligations? And that's really what Dr. Carr is focusing on. I think there's some interesting opportunities in that.
What sort of instruments would they be, and who would issue them?
They'd be long-term. They'd be long-term debt instruments. They're things, you know. For example, you could imagine if you had to shift a stock bank, or if you had to move a community, and you move that to you shift the stock bank so that it's better protecting some low-lying area. That takes a bit of investment. You can have Treasury created targeted infrastructure rates that allow a particular area to continue to support the investment required to shift that area over the long term. So you could have long-term instruments issued by local authorities that would invest in these adaptation programs in projects of these protection projects.
What is viable in speeding up transport transition? Because it still seems to be very slow. And again, are we missing opportunities, perhaps involving both public and private sectors, on accelerating it?
Well, what is viable there? Well, there's different fleets. You've got the heavy fleets and the passenger, the public transport fleets. And thinking about how do you distribute electricity to charge those? But actually, you've just got to transition the fleet. So how do you encourage that? And I think that's where cargoes, when he talks about, well, you can have some incentives and some subsidies, but actually some things you're just going to have to ban. You know, there's some activities that you've got to say, well, we can't do these. And you might do that by properly pricing carbon, which is what Emin was talking about, where if the proper impact of the decision, the investment decision on the environment is taken into account, then that option becomes a lot more expensive. It means that plant, that combustion engine is now obsolete. You've got to start mandating, like some countries have overseas, a change to so that you can't sell internal combustion engines anymore in passenger fleets beyond, you know, pick a date. Some of them have been 2030, 35, 2040 in Europe.
You're actively looking at, I know, how to price these things properly. We mentioned that with Emma also, not just pollution but damage to biodiversity, other environmental and social damage. How can you price this in as investors? What would it look like on a balance sheet or in a prospectus?
Well, I think on a balance sheet is a different question, and there's a bunch of different groups around the globe thinking about that in terms of accounting standards. From an investor perspective, really what you're saying is there are two things. One is, what's the impact on business? So what's the social impact, the social trends and the environmental trends that impact on our business outcomes? And what's the impact of business, which is what's the impact of our decisions on these societal trends? And what you're trying to do with that is find some way of creating metrics for those. And what the government's been doing is the Living Standards Framework and the Wellbeing Budget is exactly that, which says, okay, well, there's some long-term climate impacts that aren't taken into account when we make this investment. What would we have to do that? Well, we might have to price carbon properly, or we might have to, you know, restrict building in certain areas, or that kind of thing. What are the long-term social impacts? And what's been interesting in the COVID response is, when I talk to investors overseas, you know, whereas a lot of the discussion historically has been about climate change, a lot of the discussion now in terms of ESG is moved to social. What are the social impacts of companies' business decisions, and how should we think about those and try and factor those into our investment decisions? Because we've shown, this crisis has shown that resilience, companies are more resilient if they have looked after some of those social outcomes in terms of their stakeholders, customers, suppliers, employees especially.
Is the impetus still, though, or the onus still with government to regulate and or subsidise appropriately? You're talking about price and carbon. That's a government policy decision, isn't it?
Oh, that absolutely is a government policy decision, and that's government policy around the world. But it's not only a government that can do that, because that risk exists. You know, the climate change risk exists. It doesn't, and it will manifest when, you know, a government imposes a significantly higher carbon tax, or it will manifest when technology is rendered obsolete by a transition in the energy system, or it will manifest when there's a physical impact from a massive storm and a community is wiped out in terms of, you know, investment decisions. That's there, and investors like us are going to feel the impact of that risk. Governments clearly have a role, but the private sector, they all have a role as well, because they ought to be managing that risk and thinking about that, and not just saying, oh, well, that's a government piece. I think the most immediate part of the current situation, which is really useful, is that the government has become a significant consumer. And what you're trying to do when you're trying to shift the financial system to a more sustainable footing is change decisions. Well, now you've got one decision maker who's making a lot of decisions that affect the economy. And so that's a great opportunity to use that to incorporate those longer-term climate and social impacts into those investment and consumption decisions. And that's really what, you know, Em is promoting, and what Dr. Carr is promoting in terms of its climate change principles, and everybody's saying, don't go, whatever you do, don't go backwards. You know, first do no harm, but actually take advantage of the opportunity to put in place things that have lasting benefits and are not just short-term sugar hits.
And are these investors standing by for more public-private partnerships? Are there others that you might be interested in, specifically the super fund?
Yeah, there are. You know, there's plenty of investor interest in that around the world, and we work with other investors internationally and domestically to look at those projects. So there's a lot of demand from investors.
Could you be specific about potential sectors or projects in New Zealand that the super fund or other investors would be, super fund specifically, would be, you know, happy to stump up and be part of? What sort of areas?
Oh, we're looking at opportunities in real estate development, so that can include social and affordable housing. We've got a bid in on the light rail project, and that will be an indicator of whether that type of thing is something that is acceptable. But, you know, we're not doing that as a one-off. If there were other opportunities that flow from that and flow from the type of approach we're promoting there, which is we bring in an international partner with specific expertise, we introduce that international capital, and we come up with a really, you know, interesting solution to a societal problem, those are great. That's the best intersection for us.
Could we just quickly come back to Emma? In Australia, there's some big public plans underway. Again, is that where investors in the Australian market are saying, hey, look, we have got money here if you open up the opportunities? Could you give us a bit of an indication of the potential in Australia?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're actually seeing with the federal system here is that a lot of the state governments are actually coming forward as they're doing their own planning, particularly around infrastructure, around where some of the investment opportunities might be, which both help stimulate the economy but also meet the state level commitments around moving to net zero emissions by 2050. So that is not all that dissimilar. It is very much around infrastructure, it's around property, and it's around energy. And a lot of that is also around the grid. So our electricity grid and how we actually look to promote that. But also, I mean, it's a mixture of both hard and soft infrastructure. So a lot of it can be, if you put in place the right incentives through planning, through standards, through other sorts of, fiscal incentive measures, then the capital will flow into projects, because there is a lot of appetite there as well. So it's not all that dissimilar in terms of the projects, but with a really hard focus on energy in particular.
Matt, did I hear you allude to New Zealand's own grid, which of course has had some money invested in upgrading, but again, if we look to a full transition to potentially a two-way grid and really ramping it up for the increase in demand that may come if the transition happens, is that another area the super fund might be interested in?
Yeah, that type of thing, as well as, you know, how do you deal with the challenge that is Tiwai, right? If that if that electricity suddenly comes back in, and obviously the demand isn't at the bottom of the South Island anymore, that requires a further investment in the grid to get it to the places where it is demanded.
You'd have to fully hook it up to the national grid. And again, you're saying, as an investor, that's the sort of project you'd be interested in.
Yeah, look, we're interested in our mandate is a commercial one. We're here to generate a return on behalf of all New Zealanders, and if we can find something that has that meets those investment hurdles, absolutely, we'll be interested.
Just finally, has the impact of COVID affected your asset investment strategy in an ongoing way at all? I heard you say you're looking through, right? But are there some things that you have fundamentally changed your mind on? Warren Buffett, no less, has fundamentally changed your mind on as a result of what's just happened, Matt.
Well, what we do with that, and so we've had to think about our long run interest rate assumptions. So with the activity of central banks around the world, and with Adrian here, obviously, you expect to have very low interest rates for a long time as central banks try to provide liquidity to get markets moving again, and so that's something that we've done. We've incorporated in our current long run assumptions, and then that affects how we operate our strategic tilting strategy, which is a contrarian strategy that was doing the buying I was talking about on the way down and the selling on the way up. So there are certain things at a macro level that we've done, but also at an individual sort of sector level, as we think about where we make direct investments. Obviously, there are big impacts on sectors, disproportionate impacts on different sectors. Most of them negative, some of them potentially positive. But certainly it affects as we look to prioritise where we make our direct investments locally, that's going to affect that.
I thank both of you very much for your time. Matt Winneray there is Chief Executive of the New Zealand Super Fund, also co-chair of the Sustainable Finance Forum. Thanks also to Emma Hurd, Chief Executive of the Investor Group on Climate Change. This Australasian group of big investors has something like $2 trillion under investment, joining global institutional investors around the world in calling on governments to focus on sustainable and transitional projects when they do their stimulus post-COVID.